Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Hello there and welcome to the Weekend Podcast. Follow us on Spotify for this weekly selection of our favourite chats from the last couple of days. On this episode, Katrina McInaspy gave her reaction to the verdict of unlawful killing following the inquest into the death of her 17-year-old brother Daniel, who was murdered in 2010 while in the state care system. Then actor Sirka Cusack on her latest play, Escaped Alone, and being part of the Cusack acting dynasty. Elaine Feeney, Let Me Go Mad in My Own Name is the name of her novel, one of my favourite books so far this year. We had a lovely chat with her about Athenry and Galway. Rex Ryan on his new play, The Monk, inspired by Jerry Hutch. So first up, Katrina McInaspy spoke about her brother Daniel, murdered in a park at the age of 17. He was the first child to be killed while in the care of the state in 2010. Daniel's inquest was only held this month. It recommended a review of child welfare services. A change of tone then, because Sirka Cusack came in and she had a lovely chat with us about a Carol Churchill play. She talked about growing up in the Cusack acting dynasty and also playing Brad Pitt's mother in the movie Snatch from 25 years ago. Booker, long-listed Galwegian Elaine Feeney dropped in to talk about her new book, Let Me Go Mad in My Own Way. Set in her native Athenry, it tackles dysfunctional families in rural Ireland, intergenerational trauma across three generations. It's got everything, really, from the black and tans to online tradwives. And finally, Rex Ryan came in to talk about the challenges and huge controversies surrounding Jerry Hutch, on whom he's based his new one-man show, The Monk. So into the podcast we go. Daniel McInaspy was the first child to be killed while in the care of the state. Daniel had 20 different care placements in the 15 months before his death. State agencies, they knew he was in danger. They knew he needed secure accommodation, even perhaps abroad, for his own protection. However, he was repeatedly failed by many state agencies. And in 2010, at the age of just 17, he was murdered in a park. His inquest was only held this month and it recommended a review of child welfare services, among other recommendations too. His older sister, Katrina McInaspy, joins us now. Katrina, welcome. This has been a very long ordeal, hasn't it, for you and your family? Can I begin where, when you and Daniel, he was Dano to the family, was
he? Yeah, he was.
Dano. When you were growing up, Finglas was home.
Yeah.
What are your memories of home in your childhood years?
We were young, we were all together. Happy times, but hard times as well.
How many of you, in terms of siblings, were in the family?
There's six of us.
And you were a couple of years older than?
Yeah, I'm Daniel's older sister, so I'm 4 years older than Daniel.
As you say, hard times as well. So there are happy memories. You and your siblings are taken into care in kind of stages, is that right?
No, we all went together. They came to me, Mum, and it was going to be a big family home. And my mum could come with us, so we'd be all together.
And it was just your mum at this stage because...
Yeah, my dad had passed away.
He had died and you were very young.
He died Christmas Day in 96.
Christmas Day?
Yeah.
Can I ask what happened to
him?
He
had a heart attack.
Really?
Yeah, so that's why my mum, obviously, she had six kids under the age of 10 on her own. And she fell on hard times herself, so that's why we ended up in...
Naturally here. Enough to difficult to survive losing your partner in life on a Christmas Day with so many small children. And then your mother becomes unwell.
Yeah, yeah. She turned to drink, you know. So she did come with us to the house in Montpellier. We were all together and we were told we'd stay together. But unfortunately, me mum, you know, it was quite hard for seeing her kids obviously kind of taken off her.
Yeah.
So she turned to drink and she went to rehab, but... She came out, she wasn't allowed back to the home with us, so...
Devastation again.
Yeah, so that took an effect on her, so she turned to alcohol, so...
Addiction essentially kills her.
Yeah.
What age are you when she dies?
I was 17.
Daniel, he wasn't even a teenager at this point.
No.
What happens then? Because you're kind of, do you break up as a family? What initially
well,
occurs?
Well, we were still living in Montpellier as a family, like as brothers and sisters, you know, and we were told we'd stay together. But unfortunately, when my mum left, we kind of started playing up. You know, we were told we'd be with her. So when she didn't get to come home to us, to the house, we kind of all started playing up, you know. I was missing school, I was going off with my friends, and then eventually they just start taking us one by one out of the house. I was me first, then my sister, then me, I think it was Daniel, and then from that there was me two younger brothers and sisters. They were left.
And is they the HSE, because they're responsible for child welfare at the time?
Yeah.
Daniel, what was he, or Dano as you knew him, what was he like as a kid when you were all still together?
Oh, he was so funny. He just wanted to make everyone laugh.
Really?
All the time. Like, you couldn't be around him without laughing. Everything was a joke to him, and he just wanted everyone to be like laugh all the time.
You were all close?
Yeah, very close.
Were you able to put manners on him at all as then?
Yeah, he would listen. Yeah,
would he?
He would, mind you. But then when I moved out, you know, his older sister's gone now. His mum was gone. So he found it very hard because we were really close. So he did find it hard.
Everyone found it difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, you turned to drink yourself out
I
of,
did, yeah.
In your early teenage years.
Hanging around parks, yeah. So, yeah, I, you know, you just want your family, like, so my mother, like, you know, as much as she had her own problems, but we still loved her, you know.
She just had an illness, you know, she was in grief. She had the illness of addiction.
Maybe if they, you know, said that the help they she could have got as well, maybe.
How do you get your life together? Because you do very quickly, don't you? Thankfully, the
well, I did. I ended up in a girls' hostel in Ballymun. I had left school at that point. I wasn't going. I just kind of gave up. But I went there and I just kind of taught my life around by the help of Finola Dolan. She was brilliant.
Was Finola Dolan? She was the
like ran the girls' hostel. So she would have been in our family previous to my own brothers and sisters. My two aunties lived there before us many years ago. So
she organised education, everything for you, did she?
Yeah, she got me back into school and I ended up doing me leaving. And then I was still after that, I was saying I was leaving. She just kept pushing me and I was the first Mac and Aspie to do me leaving cert.
You must look at that kid that you were back then. And
yeah,
go,
I do.
What an achievement.
Well, yeah, I wish I had done further, but I got to me leaving, so I'm happy with that.
With everything that had gone on.
Yeah.
So you got your life together. Nikita was another younger sister of yours.
Yeah, she came then to live with me in the girls' hostel. She also done her leaving as well. Like,
and how stable was your lives together at that point?
Well, we had each other, so it was kind of good, you know. Mm. And we had each other. Like that, Daniel and my brother Keith, they were very, very close.
Yeah.
So they had each other. And then when they got split,
yeah,
that was really, really hard for both of them. One went to live with me auntie Pamela and, well, Keith. And then obviously Daniel was moved around. That's when it kind of starts.
Because we can see when you got help, you and Nikita, that your life comes together and you go on to have a normal life despite the horrible trauma and grief in your life. The documents that come out of the inquest show that the failings really begin for Daniel when he's taken into care, isn't he? He loses education effectively as a result of simple things not being noticed, like he had dyslexia.
Yeah, like in the inquest, like, we heard a child that has dyslexia, you should be second class, you know, where that they should have known. But Daniel was like,
it's an easy thing to sort out, to educate people with dyslexia.
So, I think he was like 14, 15 before that came.
And that's when they realised, but at that stage he can't read or write.
No, and from a very young age, that's all he ever wanted to do.
It's very sad because he liked school.
Yeah, yeah, he really, really did. He wanted to learn. Mm. And, you know, obviously his little mind, and he didn't realise, why can't they? But he was never told. He obviously knew he couldn't read and write, and that, like, he was embarrassed about that.
Really?
Yeah, he was very embarrassed about that. Like, so that's one thing he really wanted to do, was to read and write.
Like, to carry that shame around with him, it's just appalling, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because that's the simplest thing in the world to fix. And it was just dyslexia. Lots of people have very, very intelligent people as well.
Yeah.
He had a positive regard for school. He leaves school, obviously, because he's not taken care of there. And he ends up living in the streets, essentially. He's even attacked quite dangerously, isn't he?
Yeah, he got 14. Stabbed when he was 14 in the neck.
In the neck?
Yeah, in the neck. Roaming the streets of the city centre.
He ends up in Temple Street Children's Hospital.
He did, yeah.
Where was he living then at that stage? Do you know where he was sleeping?
No. I'd imagine it was there out of service. But after that, that's when my auntie Sabrina took Daniel.
You had great aunties.
Yeah, they were brilliant and still are brilliant to us.
And I'm sure they had their own things going on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they had a lot of trauma in their own lives, you know, but they stood by us all.
So Auntie Sabrina's trying to take in Daniel around this time. He's yeah. been attacked and injured on the street. He doesn't have any school. But then Daniel, being a nice kid, he doesn't really want to be a burden to Auntie Sabrina. Is that right?
No, he was in with my other aunties, a couple of them before that. But like that, you know, space, they had their own kids, you know, they still took them. But after then the attack on him, Sabrina did take him, and he lived with Sabrina for like 2 years.
Right.
And she got him into FOSS, the Youth Reach Centre.
Yeah.
He was doing well, but it broke down again because, like, no one came to Sabrina to see how Daniel was, see were they okay. He was just left there, and
there was no follow up or connection to who.
Not really, no, no.
And there's an incident in the FOSS course, which again comes back to the shame of his dyslexia, not being able to read or write, and this has a profound impact on him.
Yeah,
can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, like that, he wanted to read and write, and there was like obviously a group in his FOSS, and he was just got embarrassed, like if he had to read out or
he was asked to read something out loud. Was that?
Yeah, it was something like that. And like that, he was embarrassed that he couldn't do it. Like, so that he left.
He leaves the court, and that's the only stable thing, really.
That really was.
So
yeah.
Naturally, he ends up back on the streets, about 15 years of age. People will be familiar with the chaotic life of people in this area, particularly who work in this area, someone with no education, no work. He's a young teenager. Drugs are readily yeah. available on the streets, and that's
and
what happens.
And that's what he turned to, yeah. He, you know, he's a 15-year-old on the streets. You know, all he's looking for is a family, somewhere safe. He had us as a family, but, I mean, he knew, he always felt that he was a burden to us, like, as in,
you were getting on with your life. No.
Yeah, and, you know, he knew there was never room, and he just wanted the HSE just to provide him with security, you know, so.
Did you have much contact with him during that time?
Yeah, all the time. He wouldn't, you know, he was always around us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He really desperately wants help. He's taking tablets, smoking cannabis. There was a suicide attempt.
Yeah, I didn't know that until I heard it in the inquest.
You didn't know that until now, really?
Yeah, I didn't know that about the suicide attempt. I heard that in court, so.
What do you know about it? Is he taken to hospital? Does he get any care?
Yeah, I think he was taken to hospital, yeah, to Temple Street, and there was nothing they could do for him or something, so. Again, he was left on the streets.
He's back out even after that.
Mm. And that's when I think he knew himself he needed help and he wanted to help. And
along the way, the HSE appoints, or there's someone appointed by the courts, is that right, by the HSE to represent Daniel in legal proceedings. He's not taking drugs, I believe, for this period.
No, they drug test him and it came back clear.
So he was fighting to live and
he
to survive.
Really was.
How does he get someone appointed to him in the end? What?
Well, Aileen was appointed to all of us, I think, when my mum passed away. So we were...
I see, there is a contact there.
Yeah, we didn't need her anymore. So she was gone. But the social workers went back and asked her for help to be Daniel's voice.
Okay.
So that's how she comes back on the scene.
So little bits of the system work here. And Aileen Dunn is her name.
Yeah. Yeah,
formidable, brilliant woman.
Yeah.
And really cares about her
job. She really did, and she really tried her best.
She had lovely things to say about your brother.
And she got very, very upset in court.
In the inquest.
A couple of times.
What did she tell you at the inquest about Daniel?
He was like that, funny. Like that, he wanted help, and she knew that. And she was his voice, and she, like, Daniel kept saying to her, like, I really need somewhere to go. And she fought for that, and... And never happened.
She said he didn't have a bad bone in his body. And that was important because when he, and the way he's killed in the end, all sorts of rumours swirl about anyone who is even just adjacent to drugs or being
a lot of people has came out and kind of said Daniel was murdered over a drug debt. That's not true.
Totally false.
Daniel was ended up in Blanche that night to meet a girl. and just came across these two guys, and that's why he was killed. Like, but it was nothing got to do with drugs or anything like that.
Aileen Dunn, nobody really works harder than her. She pushes for secure accommodation over and over again, doesn't she?
Yeah.
How badly is the state failing in this regard? How many attempts are made to get him accommodation?
There was like 3 or 4 applications, and every one of them were refused. And she said he met all the ticks that for someone to be in a secure unit, Daniel met each and every one of those ticks for him to be in a secure unit.
Because he was in danger?
Yeah.
And repeatedly the state has told over and over.
What child asks to be locked up? You know, he asked that.
Yeah.
For, you know, he wanted help, and he, that was the only way out. Lock me up, help me.
Again, at the time, it's not TUSLA, which is the organisation people are familiar with these days, it's the HSE Care Committee. They're told 3 times in the year before he's murdered that he needs somewhere safe. But there was no bed. Is that the reason?
This is what we've been told, yeah. There was no beds available for Daniel.
There was talk about sending him to Sweden to a treatment care.
Yeah, Sweden. And that was refused.
There was a clinical psychologist who spoke to the inquest, and he met Daniel 20 times, I think it was. You'd never heard from this person before.
I never heard his report, and that shocked me.
What did you find out?
A lot. That Daniel had post-traumatic stress disorder. He had the... I'm forgetting the word. he had a few things going on, and just... One that stuck out with me was the fact that he was in court the day before Daniel was murdered, like saying this child needs to be put away, like locked up for his own safety. He's not
The day before?
The day before. And that shocked me.
And this took 15 years for you to find out?
Yeah. And he had said in his report that if he didn't get anywhere safe, that he wouldn't make it 12 months. And the next day, Daniel's murdered.
It's extraordinary. He knew exactly what was going on. And I believe that psychologists had never written that in a report before about a kid in these circumstances.
Yeah.
That's how much danger Daniel
was in.
McInaspy was
and
in.
And I was that has stuck with me since the day of that court, because like I blamed myself for many, many years.
God, yeah.
You know, and but it's kind of given me, I shouldn't blame myself, because it was HSC that should have been really protecting him, not me. He was under their care.
It's very clear now. How do you know in February 2010 that Daniel is missing?
We couldn't get through to him.
Right, because you're so used to contact.
Yeah. And from there, yeah.
He's missing for quite some time, isn't he, before you find out what happens?
12, 13 weeks.
What are those weeks like?
Oh, morning to night, we searched fields, ditches. We searched the whole of Blanchardstown. Day in, day out. There wasn't a day we did not go out. And I had a young daughter at the time, and she didn't get to see her mummy for 3 months because my focus was to find Daniel. So that, you know, it took a lot on us searching every day. Like, we were never going to give up. But.
And 3 months later, you get the worst news.
Yeah, that he was found in a ditch.
Do you remember being told or how you found out on that day?
Well, I think they came to us and told us they found a remains of a body. So obviously it took a few days to say it was Daniel. But yeah, I was happy that we had him.
Really?
Because we've been searching. I was devastated that what happened to him, but we had him home. You know, with us.
So you knew that he had been murdered, but the body was moved.
Yeah.
And that's when he was finally tracked down. When it occurred, I presume you always had hope that he would have a normal life at some point.
Yeah.
Were you always fearful? Did you always half think this might happen?
Not murdered, no. I always knew he was in danger, hanging around town.
Yeah.
I suppose there was always danger for Daniel, you know, where he was hanging around. But it was still a shock to us that he was murdered.
Teenage boys, 17 years of age, they don't get murdered every day in Ireland, thankfully. It was a brutal murder. The circumstances of moving the body were horrific. Two men responsible were convicted. There were many trial delays here, which must have been very difficult for you as well. Richard Decker from Blanchardstown in 2017, he's convicted of murder. He was sentenced to life in prison. This was after a retrial, mm-hmm. and then he'd an appeal that reached all the way to the Supreme Court. That was rejected just 3 years ago. Trevor Noon, also from Blanchardstown, was convicted of manslaughter. He was sentenced to 13 years. He served 6 years and was released in 2023. Extraordinary. This must have made your grief ever more difficult.
Yeah, it's like he's living his life now. We're still fighting for our brother Daniel. You know, we're Daniel's voice now, but he's out.
Trevor Noon is out.
He's out now. Like
Richard
you know.
Decker is still in prison.
Yeah.
Did you ever find out why they did it?
They're evil. They done a lot of things to other people. You know, Daniel was just out there having kids. Trying to meet a girl, and he just happened to meet this,
and that's it.
They thought Daniel had nobody, like family, or he obviously mentioned he lived in care or whatever, and they just
an opportunistic thought. Killing. The fight for justice then turns to how the state didn't protect him. The murders in 2010, the inquest has only just happened. Very upsetting to go through it all again.
Yeah, just brings it all back. And you know, like, obviously we know about the murder and we knew a lot, you know. But I was just shocked in the inquest to hear some stuff I didn't even know, like the doctor's report, and just, like, it's just horrible.
It's like there are two trains of justice here. You've had the criminal one, and those people have criminal responsibility. But then you just have the care the state should have provided and they didn't. Mm. But it was, a moment of justice to have a jury agree with you.
Oh, yes, that was. And I'd like to thank the jury. Yeah, it was great that we had them on our side, you know, and they could see how wrong Daniel was let down, you know. So it was really nice that they were on our side.
So their overall verdict, obviously unlawful killing, but the recommendations they gave is that the state should carry out a review of its funding to child protection services by TUSLA to ensure it has the ability to keep children safe. They said the child's voice should be front and centre. That was really important to you, wasn't it?
Yes.
Does the state today, that was 2010, it's now 15 years on, does the state have the ability, the HSC, TUSLA, to stop this from happening again?
I really, really hope, but you know, as you said, Daniel was murdered in 2010. We're now 2025 and there's still kids waiting for beds. Mm. You know, it was the HSC when that happened to Daniel, TUSLA took over and nothing has changed. In all those years, you think something would change.
In terms of the level of care.
Yeah.
The inquest heard there are four young people who've been approved by the High Court for special care. They still were awaiting placement at the time of the inquest. And we also heard that due to a lack of staff, only 14 of 26 specialist care beds in the state's three facilities are open. We only have 26 beds. We can only open 14.
Yeah. That's shocking.
It is genuinely shocking.
It really is.
Considering what's happened already in the past, what do you want to happen next?
I really, really hope TUSLA wake up and help these young kids, because it won't be long before someone else ends up dead, like, and I really, really don't want another family to have to go through this again, because the heartache we've went through for 15 years, I just couldn't imagine another family going through it. It's really sad. So I really hope they open their eyes and things really, really change, you know.
That's for the present and future kids in care. What yeah. do you want the state to say to the McAnaspie family?
We've never had an apology off them. In 15 years, they've never came to us. They've never offered us counselling. They've never offered us any of my family to see how we've done in these 15 years. Mm. Nothing from them.
You could do with counselling?
Yeah, honestly, I could. You know, it's 15 years, but, you know, they probably thought we were going away. But we're not going away. You know, we're still fighting for Daniel's voice and we will continue to do that.
It seems like a simple request, doesn't it? A formal state apology.
Yeah.
For failings that a jury has agreed with of our fellow citizens. Mm. It's very clear that the failings have been laid out. That's all you're looking for.
Yeah.
Are you going to take on the HSE for the failings of the past as well?
It was never ever in my mind, but after the inquest and what I heard and how bad they failed Daniel, that's something I'm looking into.
In terms of a legal, perhaps,
yes,
a legal action?
Yeah.
Because you were not told so much about his care and the failures of the care.
You know, and they need to be held accountable. So, you know, I really think they need to, be held accountable. And I'm, you know, as I said, we never got a sorry. We've never been offered support, help in 15 years. So, I am going to.
People will be shocked by that. Let's go back to Daniel, because he would have been 30, wouldn't he, 2 years ago?
32 years ago, yeah.
Your family came together for his what would have been his 30th at the grave. What did you do that day?
We got a big banner. We brought champagne with his picture on it. Champagne. Yeah, we just celebrated him. Sad, but we had all our little kids with us that never met Daniel, but they all know him.
Go ahead, yeah.
And they all singing and, you know, let balloons off for him, and it was quite hard. But seeing our little air kids now known of their uncle or their cousin celebrating his life, it was lovely to see, but also very hard.
Yeah, but they get to know him a bit, don't they?
Yeah, they like, you'd ask any of the children in our family, Daniel, and they would all tell you, they all feel like they've met Daniel, you know, but they haven't, but they'll talk like they did.
That's a lovely scene that you're painting for us, and all the McInaspys are your close knit family still.
Oh yeah,
and all gathered for little Dano.
Yeah, sad. We do it every year, but we made that one special because, you know,
of course, yeah,
he would have been 30.
He was only 17. How are you now? How are you in your life?
I'm good. You know, I have two kids, so all good, but you know, last week, you know, it's bringing a lot back. So I'm just trying to take a step, you know, for myself.
Yeah.
But
it must be incredible, because I think one of your kids only turning 17 at the moment.
Yeah, that hurts me at the minute. I'm scared just to see her, you know, her age was Daniel's age when he was murdered. So it's quite, you know, don't do this, don't do that, don't go there. You know, it's not her fault, but at the same
time, she's still a kid to you.
Yeah, and you never get over that fear of something bad happening.
Really, that's still in there.
Oh yeah, and when you have a daughter that age, that fear will never go. I don't think it ever will.
You're an extraordinary woman, you know that.
Thanks.
And Nikita, who came with you here today as well, like, incredible woman to get through that. It's just extraordinary. But to keep on fighting at the level you're doing at it now, we can only wish you well. I know it's been a difficult time, even coming to chat to us today.
Thanks for having us.
Not at all. Absolutely amazed by you. And I'm delighted to hear that everything is well in your life. And we can just wish you well.
Thanks very much.
He'd be very proud of his big sister, I'm sure.
I hope so.
And for the work you're doing for the other kids as well. You couldn't do any more. Katrina McInaspy, thank you so much. And a reminder to people out there that supports are available on rte.ie/helplines. Surname Cusack is synonymous with acting in this country. The family has produced generations of stars of stage and screen, producing front and behind cameras and all over the place. Sorica, or is it Sorica, by the way?
Sorica.
Sorica. It's wrong in both ways. Sorica, Cusack's TV credits include Murdoch Mysteries, This Way Up, we could be here for a while now, Father Brown, Silent Witness, Casualty, Merlin, Mrs Brown's Boys, and Coronation Street. And you're back home here. This is your native Dublin.
It is, most certainly.
You've been out of it for a while, though, haven't you? And this play is called Escaped Alone by Carol Churchill, and in the Everyman Theatre in Cork, the Project Arts Centre in Dublin next month. We'll tell everybody all the details, but welcome, Gia Grich, agus fáilte.
Gairm agat.
You see, I'm always nervous in front of people with a Gaeilge leafa.
Ah, no, to an Gaeilge Jarom a Dagum.
Not at all, I'd say. You're absolutely amazing at it. Where are you usually based? England is home?
England, yeah.
a beautiful, Kent is a lovely part of it.
We did. We moved from London about 10 years ago and we're on the south coast and can see France on a clear day.
Can you really?
Yeah, just we're literally overlooking the channel. So it is very beautiful and actually reminds me, I think one of the reasons when we did move and found this house, it was very like where I was brought up in Dorking.
Right, okay, yeah. So that was nice.
It's the same kind of feel. Not Dorking as it is now.
All right.
Dorking as it was then, which was a sleepy little village.
Ah, sleepy village.
Not full of very famous, wealthy people.
Except for you and the family, people.
We weren't wealthy. Well known, sorry.
Yes. So, but Dorking was just a normal working village, is what you're saying.
It was.
I know. Well, it still is for some people there. They're surrounded.
It's quite changed. There are quite a lot of delicatessen shops.
I'm trying to be friendly too. Yeah. That's the first sign.
I have nothing against it.
You don't know. That's the first sign of it. When you're not rehearsing, and of course your husband is an English actor.
He is.
Acting right throughout that house as well.
Yes.
When you're not rehearsing and performing, because you're very busy, you've worked all your life.
Yes, so I'm winding down. I'm very old.
You're very fresh-faced looking, but of course all the Cusacks are, aren't they?
Well, I don't know about that.
What do you do when you're not acting and performing? Is there
I do the same things like everyone else. Like I'm a mad gardener.
Oh, good.
We now have our first grandchild, and that is a big pleasure and enjoyment, and a time-consuming activity also.
Is it really?
Oh yeah.
For Granny, it is.
Yeah, we they're based in London, but Friday is our day. She's called Brianna, and it's our Brianna day.
Of the Brianna, what happens on a Brianna day?
Oh, we go swimming, we go to museums. She's only coming up to three, got obsessed by churches. So I took her to St. Paul's. I thought that was a good beginning.
That's a good place to go, yeah, for sure. And are you Nan then?
Rather? No, I'm Soracle because my husband calls me Soraka the Oracle.
Ah, so very nice.
To Brianna, I'm called Soracle.
You've even changed that convention.
Yes.
Not a nan or a grandma.
No.
There is something you do when you're spending time with your granddaughter. Do you think about yourself as a child or do you think of yourself as a mum? What is that dynamic like?
What I think is I have the time and pleasure to see the world through her eyes, which are totally curious and which I don't remember ever having had that time when my own kids were that age, because you were mad scrabbling about for work, you know, just life. It was all consuming. So it's a fantastic excitement.
It does feel like, I don't know if this is correct, but it does feel like the generation of grandparents now are probably more involved maybe than the previous ones. Is that?
Well, I think they're very necessary. I mean,
yeah.
You know, I don't think any, if it's a couple, they both need to work just to survive, pay the rent, the mortgage, whatever it is.
So the grandparents are...
Grandparents are kind of very essential.
To rescue things.
Well, to take over a bit.
Yeah.
You know, give them a day off or give them a day when they've got a lot of work on or whatever.
We've got everything backwards now, don't we?
That's what it feels like. However, I'm on the lucky end. So
that's your life at home. What's your view towards Ireland now? Do you miss the place? Do you kind of feel like you half live here, even though you've been gone for a long time?
I think for me, the older I get, the more I realise how deep my roots are here. And even though we speak ostensibly the same language, it's a very different conversation you have over in England. Whereas here, you're immediately into contact with people. It's much easier. That's what I find.
You latch back into all those vowels and...
Well, it's just people are more open and there doesn't seem... Maybe it just isn't beset by the class system in the same way that England is. And also in England, because I'm on the telly or whatever, people think they can't really talk to me as you would to an ordinary person.
What do you get when people come up to you?
You know, all the usual things about the big thing is, what have I seen you in?
And do they ask that rude question even though they recognise you?
So I used to say, well, I was in that. They say, no. I was in, no.
You have to list out.
So now I say, listen, I've been around for about 60 years. You can't have missed me. Yeah. And I can't remember what I was in. And that gets me off the hook.
I'd imagine Father Brown and Casualty, I'd say, is the one that you get. Different generations will see different things, will they?
That's exactly it. And because I was in Casualty for 2-3 years or whatever.
Really? That seems... I thought you were there for much longer.
Oh, did you? Well, yeah. People... I get the bonus of people thinking I'm Brenda Fricker as well. Right. Because she was a lovely one. She was brilliant. She was a lovely, warm Irish one. Yeah. And then I was brought in as a kind of nearly warm Irish one. And we have been kind of glued together. So I am often asked where my Oscar is. And then I have to admit that, alas, no Oscar.
Oh, no, you should keep that going.
Yeah.
You should go, it's on the fridge in the house in the Liberties. You know, you steal the stories. Home Alone 2, oh, that was mad. Was there a production, because you were there for quite long TV productions, beloved shows. Was there one that you go, oh my God, yes, I loved my time on that?
On television?
Yeah.
Not really.
No?
No. I mean, you know, Father Brown was very nice, easy, and it started off very well written, I think, and the standard was very good.
It's hard to keep it sustainable.
You know, it's not, the real challenges are always going to be maybe in film and theatre most.
Are you a theatre gal at heart?
No, I don't believe I am. I find it too terrifying.
Oh, right, okay. And theatre people say they don't find the TV terrifying because they've only the couple of takes to get it right. Whereas they can change each night.
There's a lot of pressure, but I started very young. I started in RTE.
Oh, yeah.
As I came in, I thought, oh my God, I started here doing little Irish language programmes called Lauer Gael Galin.
Oh.
And I would have been about 17, 15, 16.
Wow.
So that's where I started. So I learnt an awful lot doing those kind of very, very basic programmes. But theatre is wonderful and I love going to the theatre. But it's a big challenge being on the other side of the lights. Yeah.
Have you been to the theatre here lately?
I have.
Oh, you have, yeah.
I went to see Love Song the other night. Good. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it. I'm down to see it.
Very good.
It's in the gate for a little while, isn't it?
I'm not sure what their dates are. It's lovely and a fantastic cast and well worth a go.
And you have that nice relief of sitting in the audience and not...
Yes.
I have a kind of a panic looking up at them, even though I've only done one theatre thing ever for like a couple of nights, of going, how are they going to do? And you kind of, I have the fear of what if something goes wrong? And
that's very empathetic.
or slightly mad. Tell us about the play you're doing, because this is the scary one, Escaped Alone.
Yes.
Carol Churchill. I don't think we're hugely familiar in Ireland, but she's a huge name in theatre in Britain. And still around. She's in her mid-80s.
She is.
This is something she wrote, I think, in her 70s.
Exactly.
Well, why don't I shut up and let you tell?
Well, I think that's very pertinent because the four characters, all women, are all, she stipulates, at least 70. Some people are more 70 than others.
They're the notes. Okay.
And she's a very particular writer, very brilliant, but it's not an easy one to give you a beginning, middle and end story.
I see.
It's a bit like, you know, rubbing your tummy and tapping your head because you're doing two things at the same time. It's three women on a sunny afternoon in my character's backyard having a cup of tea, talking about the grandchildren, the children, the relations, the local high street, what they've seen on television. But that is not the whole story, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
Because the fourth character kind of invites herself in. And she prompts kind of the underlying tensions that exist.
What they're not talking about.
Correct.
Very good.
I don't know if you experience that, but I certainly have friends. There are some subjects I won't go near for fear it could cause... A rupture, I suppose.
Sour the mood.
It's sour the mood. But even worse than that, and I think this catalyst prompts the cracks to open up and you see how the women deal with it. And I think the idea, because Mrs. Jarrett, who comes in, she brings really the weight of the catastrophes that are surrounding us.
Right.
Literally. Climate, tsunamis, wars, inhumanity, the whole lot.
Starvation, the thing we thought we'd solved.
Indeed. Absolutely. It's unbearable.
Decades ago. Yeah. And there are quite funny moments, aren't there? It's a dark humour.
Everyone says this, and I'm not going to try and sell it as a rip-roaring comedy. There are. Just the foibles of people, I suppose. But the women, it does rupture things, but it's how they deal with it. And it doesn't rupture the friendship, because you see that there are always two ways of looking at something. Both might be right. Neither might be right. But the important thing is for them, the friendship is more important and survives.
They need each other.
Exactly.
Okay, but the apocalypse is unfurling all around. Now, is it kind of slightly set in the future? Are these apocalypse
it's set
happening?
In, it's set it? In no time, really.
Okay.
But the concerns are very, very much those of today.
Okay, so it speaks to us right now.
I hope.
So are you looking forward to it?
I am and I amn't.
Is it hard work every day? What rehearsing will you do today, for instance?
Oh, I certainly will. We're having our first stagger through, I think it's called.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So that'll be very revealing. Yeah.
It could be nerve-wracking when you're kind of thinking, how will I get to the when it's just flowing? But you've been there plenty of times before, you know what you're doing.
This is what we hope.
The messages are coming in already about your sisters, because, of course, there's lots of Cusack acting sisters, and about your dad. Can I ask about your mum, first of all? Because I had the pleasure of chatting to your brother, Porrick, who's the producer. He was in the National Theatre for a couple of years, wasn't he, in London? And there was a T.G. Cahir documentary, which was gorgeous. But your mother's story is incredible. Maureen.
Cusack. Maureen Keeley, born in Glenties, lived in Derry, but she and her five siblings, there were six of them, the youngest was two, and both her parents died within 1 year, and she would have been about 15 or 16.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they survived. They were so stoical and courageous, I think, and... I mean, she died very young at the age of 56
terrible,
in 1977.
Yeah.
And she still kind of is a massive influence in my heart.
Is that right?
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, she kept the show on the road, because Cyril, obviously, as he said himself, you know, my dressing room was my home, and I think it was.
That sounds awful too, doesn't it? That's where he was happiest, or was where
I
he was
think
most comfortable?
I think so, but it's really interesting looking back again from being the age I am. I could see why they met and joined each other, because in a way he was an orphan as well. And he kind of created himself, and he was a creation. And she supported that and kept us all going.
And she had all these talents. Was she brilliant piano? Did she teach piano?
No, she did not. She was an actress.
She was an actress. Well.
And I don't like to say this. What we have on film or tape, she wasn't very good in those. But I think she was wonderful on stage, because she had this kind of innocence and just sweetness and kindness and warmth.
Oh, I like that doesn't take away from your view of her, obviously.
Not at all.
Very neutrally.
Yeah, not at all. It's far less important.
All of the interviews that various Cusacks have given about your dad, the euphemism difficult is used, and like we as Irish people read into it going, oh, he was a horror.
You're far too perspicacious, aren't you?
I'm just reading between the lines everybody else would do.
But he was tricky.
He was tricky?
He was tricky, yeah. He was great when we were tiny, but as soon as we could answer back, that was the end of the road, really.
He liked to be the boss then, I presume.
Oh, for sure. And I think because he hadn't experienced family life, he kind of wanted to create a rather Victorian arrangement.
I see.
Which he just chose the wrong offspring for that.
His public persona was quite conservative as well, wasn't it? He was part of a kind of an old conservatism that was still... It was losing its
allure.
Sheen. In the 90s for sure, which would be his kind of movie heyday that I remember.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, I have to give him credit. With no help, you know, he went off to Hollywood. I mean, he had a bad experience in London and was banned.
Yeah, that was just for being... Was he tipsy on stage, which was totally out of character?
Well, they had to bring down the curtain. and he was playing opposite Vivian Leigh, who had just made Gone with the Wind. So he was at the absolute pinnacle of his career, really.
And he was trashed in the press over there.
Well, the thing is, they had to bring down the curtain, and it isn't really. It was St. Patrick's Day, and he'd gone to some, you know, shindig at the embassy or whatever. Mm-hmm. And people said, you can't go on. And he said he could.
Gosh.
And then, as far as I understand, he spoke gobbledygook and had to bring the curtain down.
Which, again, he was such a professional.
Yeah.
It was just completely. But that was a devastating moment in his life, wasn't it?
Yeah, because he didn't work in England then for decades. But he took himself off to Hollywood and made a very, very impressive film career there.
Since you don't rate your poor mum as an actor.
I hate to say that now.
I know what you mean. He was a phenomenal actor.
Phenomenal. Absolutely. I worked with him certainly twice. But again, tricky.
Is that another euphemism?
Well, the thing is, he was so good. And I said, we were doing Three Sisters, and I said, Cyril, can you know, at the beginning, Olga has this long thing, really a bit of background for the audience. And I said, can you kind of not be so busy upstage? And he said, well, I'm just, you know, I'm doing what you would do. I see Rina and I blow her a kiss, and I see the flowers on the table, and I think, oh, spring is here. I said, yeah.
So it's your line. And
he says,
drawing attention at the back.
Yeah, Chekhov says.
Chekhov.
And I said, no. Chekhov says, he comes in, sits down and reads the paper. That's what Chekhov says. And he said, well, I think it's because I'm in Ireland. People say, oh, that's Cyril up at the back. So I can't help it.
Anne is in touch and says, I had the pleasure of seeing the three Cusack sisters and their father, Cyril, in Chekhov's Three Sisters in the Gate in 1990. This is what you're talking about.
I still remember.
You fell out, did you? Did you fall out
No.
Professionally?
No, we survived. I mean, it was a difficult job for all of us, actually, because, you know, we all had our own lives. Suddenly we were thrown back into the family order.
Oh, yeah. There's a play in that in itself, isn't there? What's happening?
Well, indeed. Yeah. Not a play I would wish to see.
There are other questions in about. We'd love to hear Circa's opinion on the movie Day of the Jackal, since you are talking about your dad's acting.
Oh, yeah.
Day of the Jackal, 1973. Her dad, Cyril Cusack, had a small but crucial role as the gunsmith for the assassin. Well, he's Control in the film.
No, that's in...
In the Spy Who Came In From the Cult.
Exactly.
That's the one
exactly.
I saw last year. I'm getting confused.
And he's wonderful in that.
He's amazing in that.
Yeah, yeah.
He's kind of terrifying.
Terrifying. Cold, icy, terrifying. I was going to be
dramatic
really...
Dramatic pause there.
I was going to be mean and say typecasting. But that was not true. That was just me being a bit smart, a bit glick.
And Dave the Jackal, he is phenomenal. He's in the scene with Fox. What's his name? Is it...
Which Fox is it? That's another lot full of foxes.
Posh English actor.
Yeah.
What is your advice to aspiring actors? Would you do it again if you could go back again?
I don't know, but I think it's very difficult for actors now because the whole thing has changed. It has become a business. And I hear... doesn't affect me because I don't do social media or any of that.
Oh,
but
yes.
I hear
what you're coming to.
That in America, they want to know how many followers you've got on whatever platform it is.
That's the primary concern.
Exactly. So you really have to sell yourself. And I think because it is a business, it's not in a lot of television and film, it's not being brought through from creators like writers or producers. It's coming through people who look at ledgers and say,
that's
if
right.
We put so and 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 so, we'll have a success and we'll make lots of money.
It's terrible because it doesn't mean that talent will shine through.
Indeed.
It's probably always been the case a little bit, has it? That
the difference was, though, when I was starting, you were noticed by your theatre work and therefore offered television or film.
Oh, I see.
Now, I notice in all the programmes, they put your name and what you've been in on television
on
or
TV,
film.
Yes.
And in fact, you get invited to do things because of your credits.
And the Olivier Awards in the West End in London are increasingly going to existing movie stars who happen to do a production because it gets all
the time. I never watch them and I'm not invited. Shock horror.
The lovies are fighting with each other. Did you have a choice with this profession or because it was in the family, did you just have to do it?
Oh, a line of least resistance, I think, in the end. I mean, I did, after my degree, I did an H-dip or a dip ed, whatever it's called, and taught. And I liked it a lot. Mm. But I think I would have been wrung out after about 5 years. And I kept being asked to do things. So, yeah.
Another generation would probably recognise you from Snatch, the Guy Ritchie film.
Yes.
Where you play Brad Pitt's mother.
I know. I look in the mirror every day and I said, I can see the resemblance.
You were way too young, way too young. London gangland movie, people remember, it's about bare knuckle boxing. You're playing Brad this scene. Stephen Graham is also in this scene, a very young Stephen Graham.
Indeed.
He's incredible in adolescence, people will know.
Oh,
a little listen.
He's always incredible.
The Irish accents in this British film.
Hey man, come and look at the size of this fella. You look like a bachelor.
Get out of the way, Mickey. See if the fellas would like a drink.
No, oh, I could murder one.
We know more than done around here, I don't mind telling you.
Cup of tea for the big fella. Come on.
Don't be silly, Mickey. Offer the man a proper drink, right? Is the big fella not coming with us?
No, he's minding a car.
What do you think we are, thieves?
I know nothing like that, Miss O'Neill. Likes looking after cars.
Get dogs. Do you like dogs?
Dogs.
What?
Yeah, dogs.
Dogs? Do you like dogs?
Oh, dogs. Sure. I like dogs. I like caravans more.
You're very welcome.
You probably haven't heard it for a while, have you? Because you're laughing away listening to that clip.
No, I haven't. But I remember when the kids were small, we were driving somewhere and they were in the back of the car and they were playing a game where they'd say a line from a play, from a film,
yeah,
and the other would guess it.
Oh.
And I said, how do you know all these? And they said, you'll know this one. And they said, dogs, do you like dogs? And I had no idea.
That's Snatch from 25 years ago.
There you go.
Believe now. You have happy memories making that film because you looked
yes,
like you had fun.
Yes, I did. It was like making a home movie.
Really?
That's yes. It was in the most unglamorous, it was a place called Perivale, which is a kind of on the outskirts of London, very grim, very industrial.
Mm-hmm.
And because they were all lads and it was all very laddish,
right,
they treated me a bit like the Dowager Duchess. And they were very respectful.
Proper order.
Yes.
It's kind of, I think it's a Midlands accent you're doing there, is it? Teeves.
I think it's a pikey accent, they said.
Is that what they called it, of course? Yes.
Well, no, I
can't. Pejorative that they would have had in the script.
I know. I'd never heard the word pikey, actually.
Yeah, no, it's a slur.
Is it a slur?
But it was in the script at the time and the year 2000 was far, far.
I'd never heard of it. But we did have, I can't remember where the accent was from, Midlands.
I detect in Midlands. It's finely done.
Thank you very
much.
It's
very, very well done. Warmest wishes to Sorica, says this message. We were at Trinity together way, way back.
No.
We were longing to join the Players Theatre, which is full of top talent. Very intimidating. We both formed a pact that we'd go together to join the queue on the day that you could queue up outside to request to join. I thought she would not be nervous because of her family background and took encouragement from that. We both joined. Her talent was obvious. Her reputation soared. She was in so many big productions and the rest, as they say. So
who is this person?
And this is Pauline. Pauline or Pauline? It looks like Pauline.
Pauline. No, I can see her face.
It recalls you in the Glash Menagerie.
Menagerie.
And watched in awe because you were nervous back then. And look at you now.
Always was. Always will be.
Thanks a million for coming in to chat to us.
Yes. And you'll tell everyone.
I'm telling everyone. Sorcha Cusack is in Escaped Alone by Carol Churchill, Everyman Theatre, Cork. That's part of the Cork Midsummer Festival
in
the middle
exactly.
of June. The
yep.
Project Arts Centre in Dublin at the end of June. HatchTheatreCompany.com.
Is where you'll get all the details. And also, in it, there's no starring, by the way. We're all equal.
You are.
There's Ruth McCabe, Deirdre Monaghan and Anna Healy.
Amazing cast.
We're the Terrible Quartet.
Can't wait. I'll have to go along to that myself, yeah, if I can get in between all the other plays going on.
Brilliant.
Sorcha, Gura Míle Maggat.
Gura Maggat, sir.
Elaine Feeney's third novel is out. It's called Let Me Go Mad. In My Own Way. Great title. Her previous one, How to Build a Boat, as you know, was nominated for a Booker Prize. And now she's looking at an Irish family home across three generations. There's violence, there's certainly horses and English fellas wandering into Galway with no idea what's in store for them. Elaine Feeney is here to tell us all about it. Congratulations on the novel.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
You're very, very welcome. Let me go mad in my own way. It almost sounds like an expression, an Irish thing we'd say, but no, it's from the classics,
it
I
is,
gather.
It is, actually, yeah, it's very old. It's from Electra, so we can blame Sophocles, and it's a translation by Anne Carson. But it really, yeah, it's a kind of, there's an Irish kind of shtick to it a little bit, I think.
The Greeks knew us
they
so
did.
Well.
Yeah, well, the Greeks knew tragedy and madness. And the great
Sophocles,
chorus.
He's the great tragedy. So like, you're straight into that. Going, yeah, I'll find something here. And is it, let me know, let you know this or something. Is that the full phrase?
Yeah.
Let me go mad. Yeah. I can tell you this.
Yeah. Well, there's many, many different translations, but
of
absolutely.
Course,
yeah.
That's the one you stick to.
Yeah.
Tell us about the road that you grew up in, because I think that's the inspiration, isn't it? As it often is for you.
It is. It is. I've been sort of, you know, in the same space for quite some time now with these novels. I may never move out of them. But so I bought the bungalow that I grew up in my 20s and for better or worse decided to stay there and see if I could write the West in a way. I don't know if I thought about it in that sort of lofty sense at that time. I think maybe I just was, you know, interested in moving back home. And there have been many generations, and I say many because I don't actually know how many, and I don't want to know, interestingly. That's, yeah. So my grandparents had lived on that road, my parents, cousins, and so on. So, yeah.
The farms. This is East Galway.
This is East Galway,
with its turf cutting along the nice kind of...
tractors, hay.
Damp hedges, but nice and warm. Because it's different from the... completely different to West Galway, isn't it?
It's very different.
It's inland.
Yeah. It's inland, yeah. So it's very green and it's very inland. And obviously... you know, I like the space. And I hadn't looked at Athenry before for a novel. You know, How to Build a Boat, I set it in a fictional town near the sea, as you were. I stuck it in a hospital. So for this novel, I really wanted to write what I knew and the stories of what I knew.
It's like a trilogy for you, these, aren't they?
Yeah.
Institutions, is it?
Yeah, yeah. So the first, so I'm obsessed with institutions and buildings and people and putting people into institutions and seeing what happens to them. So the first one was a hospital setting and it was strangers in a meet in As You Were. And then in How to Build a Boat, it's a boy in a Catholic school, quite an oppressive school. Mm-hmm. And I was interested in him in that space. But in Let Me Go Mad, My Own Way, I really wanted to interrogate the idea of the kitchen and the idea of the kitchen space in a house as the most political. So I think I worked up to weirdly the most political space, except that we never think of it like that.
No, it's totally unexpected here, but it is the place. And you're fascinated by those farmhouses where you open the front door, you were straight into the kitchen.
Correct.
And then we had the bungalow. I presume, is that, would you grow up in a bungalow?
Yeah, 1970s bungalow. And I am upset. So obviously the old house is there, and this is very present in the story. So the old houses are dotted across the West.
Yes.
And I'm fascinated by how many of them have never been knocked. Or, you
That's
know, moved.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I went on a mad trip to Clare with my husband recently. We were walking in the Burren and I met him stop at any of the abandoned ones. And I won't lie now, I did do a little bit of snooping inside. They were abandoned. It was okay. It was a lovely hot day. I'd have said, I'm lost. I'm looking for the loo. And
because they're kind of sheds now, aren't
they? Yeah, they are sheds.
Nobody tore them down.
No. No, and the Hessian sacks in some of them and 10, 20 bags and others. And
wonders inside.
Yeah, and bungalows beside them. So you had these houses and exactly what you said. They had the open kitchen. They had the loft where children slept. And then they built these bungalows in the early 70s. You know, Fintan O'Toole wrote about this in the Bungalow Nation in one of his books.
Yeah.
I didn't really understand that, but I'm fascinated by how we made the room smaller.
That's right.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like we went into individualism before we knew what capitalism was.
You're dead right.
You know,
we were mad for the front room.
Correct.
The good room, the hallway.
Good room.
And then the kitchen's out the back all of a sudden. It's a total reversal.
So the first thing I did when I bought the bungalow, well, it wasn't the first thing, when I saved a bit, I knocked the walls and made the big kitchen space.
You were ahead of your time. Did you say you were in your 20s when you got your family home?
Yeah.
And you bought it.
I did. That's very important.
Very important to mention that.
I think I have the mortgage till I'm 97.
No privilege here, I can tell you.
No, I didn't really understand the generational wealth thing. I think we're all learning about that now. Yeah.
That maybe that's West Galway. No, no, they'll be on to us as well. No, definitely not. Mayo.
No comment.
No comment, exactly. And that's the character in this story, Claire. She goes back to her home place as well, but obviously more complicated things have happened to her than have happened to you. Yeah. Tell us what goes on from the get-go.
Yeah, so Claire O'Connor is living her life in London, and her mother dies in the West in some sort of weird, unusual circumstances. It comes as a bolt from the blue. Mm-hmm. This happens very quickly, so I'm giving nothing away. This is the setup. And she returns for the funeral. And then she goes back to London, and she's living in London with Tom, her boyfriend, her partner of a decade. And she goes back to London to Tom, and she sets her life on fire. She doesn't realise it's grief and anger, and she hears her father is ill. She returns to the West to mind him and look after him. And then she's left alone in the bungalow. And she has, you know, she has, like I said, set her life on fire. So she's left Tom, who is a very unknowable individual, you know, London Tom.
A writer.
And he's
Where did you find the inspiration for this?
I don't know. And he's writing about extreme sports and ultra sports and men who take part in ultra sports. So that kind of fascinates me, you know. Tom's looking for energy in all the stories and there's, anyway, she returns back and she's faced with this bungalow on her own. She has two brothers and the past unravels through just the objects, just her in the bungalow in that space, finding things from her parents. And she starts to have conversations with them that she never had in her life, if that makes sense. She didn't really face it.
Yeah.
And she's confused. You know, Claire is quite confused, a confused character. And I suppose in some ways she's representative of the upward mobility and the progressiveness and the moves, the leaps that Ireland have taken with regards to women and agency and autonomy. She has money. Mm-hmm. She's a lecturer. She has a job. And so she's in the house. And where does she walk herself? You have all this freedom, and where she walks herself? Onto the internet. Into a deep dive on the
great sequences where you sum up the rubbish that we're all watching from, but she becomes fixated on the trad wives phenomenon on TikTok. Explain that to the uninitiated.
Well, the trad wife. Well, I don't know. Do I need to explain it? But I was getting, you know, these algorithms. So I was interested in, you know, I was looking at Claire and I was saying, what would a woman do locked in this bungalow? Because it was lockdown when she was in it, and. I said, of course, she'd scroll the internet. And you're absolutely right. And I said in the last novel, the Vanta black hole of the internet that we all go into. And it's just fascinating. I will get to the trad wife, sorry. But it's just fascinating. No, but you're just scrolling and you're scrolling at such extreme violence and such horrific scenes. And then you come to this woman making a lemon tart in a pink apron. You know, and I don't know, it just fascinated me. And what fascinated, so the trad wife movement is particularly an American thing, but they believe in the conservative values of traditional womanhood, which I do not espouse. But
shock horror. But it's kind of 50s, isn't it?
It's 50s very image of the America. 50s, and the picket fence idea.
Your man will look after you. You just look after him and everything will be grand.
Do you remember that domestic science book? Were you familiar with it? Where put a ribbon in your hair when your husband is coming in and have the dinner on the table.
I went to an all boys school. So they didn't give us
that. One for 20 years.
They didn't give us that. Up in the Louis Convent, maybe they did.
Well, the boys, when I was teaching them in the boys school, I remember saying, you know, it's just such a shock how women's history isn't included on the history course and it's such a small minority. And they said, bless, maybe they teach it across in the girls' school.
Oh my God, the same thing I said.
Anyway, so that's the trad wife movement. So Claire gets involved. Yep. Now, she's looking for some sort of control of her own life. Mm-hmm. And I think, interestingly, you know, I'm very on the fence. I had a really big idea of what I thought of trad wives.
Oh yeah.
And I won't use the language on the radio. But then when I went on my deep dive.
Oh no.
No, but I just thought again, it's about agency. Maybe they're monetizing it. Maybe it's control. Who am I to comment?
I see that view.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
And because maybe they're playing an act. So maybe the joke is on the people who think it's a great idea, but the ones who are enacting it are actually getting something out of it for themselves.
I think that's really, apt, actually, because I think we have, you know, there can be an arrogance to looking at this and then you see 10 million followers and you can 10 million followers be wrong? I have seven. You know, like, but it is this idea, but what are they looking for? Control. And then there's an awful lot of taking things out of packages, putting them into cupboards, fixing things. And but Claire gets into
she
that.
Really
she tries
does.
To control
Labeling
her life.
Labelling everything yeah. in the presses. I love
yeah,
it.
She does. Yeah.
She's so an amazing cook because...
yeah, she is.
Somehow, like, I think we need a dinner party to discuss the novel because there's so much eating that goes on.
Yeah, I needed to write the great West of Ireland dinner party. So obviously the story culminates, it goes across three timelines that we can talk about, but it kind of comes
from
to
Black and Tans to Trad Wives. There's yeah. so much fun in between here, but also
a lot of sadness,
deep stuff.
Yeah. But the dinner party scene, I did think, like, I had watched Andrew Scott and Uncle Vanya, and I was like, well, if the Russians can prance around, we certainly can now with our upward mobility and our Prosecco and Cremant.
Did you travel to see that? That's where he plays every role.
No, they live streamed it to, right. I think it was the Palau Cinema, because they did it with the Seagull as well. They used to live stream the National, but oh, he was fantastic in it.
Oh, amazing, I heard.
So absolutely outstanding. And yeah, I went back to check off, but actually there isn't a dinner party scene in Uncle Vanya, really. There's food and a lot of conversation. And here I was going, well, of course, I will set a table.
You will do a dinner.
In the bungalow.
Yeah, yeah.
And let's see what happens. And yeah.
But the clash of people who come.
Oh.
Because you've got English Tom, you've got the nice stoic man next door, the farmer.
Joe.
And because you work in academia yourself.
I
You're
do.
In Old School in Galiva.
Yeah.
University of Galway.
Oh.
Do you know people who talk like the characters of that dinner party?
Absolutely not. I have an amazing imagination and everything I write is fictional. Nobody that I know is interesting enough to put in my novels.
Talking down to a farmer who's obviously keeping his intelligence to himself.
Correct.
About the patriarchy.
Correct.
And primogeniture, is that how you say
yeah,
that word?
Yeah, the inheritance rights.
The inheritance, the first war.
Born son, yeah. Yeah, another little...
Favourite word of the thing. Was it primogeniture?
Yeah,
very good.
Well
yeah, love
done.
It. Love it. Yeah. Nearly did it.
But it is, but actually I am interested in that. I'm interested in that in the West of Ireland. I had a conversation with a friend of mine. She's an amazing comedian and she's a farmer. And there's four daughters in the family. And we had this conversation and she cannot, like her father doesn't even see that she could maybe perhaps inherit the family farm. And I said, is that to do with name? And this actually affects Claire also in the novel. She has the bungalow, but it's shared with the brothers. Yeah. And Joe next door has rented out the land.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, I think it has to do with name. I think it has to do with the name. You know, I did write in something, you have your husband's name or your father's name.
Yeah.
And I mean, that
we were talking
back
about surnames only
yeah.
yesterday and
okay.
how it's the male inheritance thing. And yeah. there is that, we need to keep the line going.
Yeah.
Why? No one even asks. Just no, that's the way it's been. That's the way
yeah.
it is.
And people do it. And it really shocks me. Like, but I, yeah. Anyway. Yeah, so the name. So I suggested maybe they need to start calling farms names, you know, name the farm.
Yeah, yeah.
And allow, you know, the women farmers to have their space.
The Brits
space.
Do that, don't they?
I'm not here to discuss the Brits' inheritance.
Well, there's an amazing sequence in the book involving the horse. We go back to 1990
yeah.
and some men have arrived and the local Irish, Anglo-Irish gentry, I think, as well.
Correct.
To recruit a horse for the Queen's mm-hmm. horse guards. Mm-hmm. But it sets up the kind of the father's brute madness towards the women
yeah.
in the house. You grew up around horses.
Mm-hmm.
What was the significance of that moment in the novel?
I was fascinated when I grew up around horses. So it sounds very lofty and bourgeois to grow up around horses. But actually, you know, there was a tradition of having a horse.
Yeah.
I was very close to my grandparents, my paternal grandparents were rural Ireland. They lived beside us. My grandfather had a pony and a cart. It's like something from Heaney.
It's great. Yeah.
I know. And we used to draw water. I'd go in the cart with them and talk to them all day. And so I loved horses from a very young age. And so there was always a horse on the farm and my grandfather couldn't drive. So I used to ask him things about the land and he'd tell me, don't mind asking those questions. And I said, where did you get these fields, you know? And he said, from Lampert's below there. And he just used to wave his hand. And this was the big house
right.
that backs onto the piece of land that my father has now inherited. And so the hunt with the Galway Blazers was a thing growing up. And I'm vehemently anti-blood sports now. But when you're a child, you have no agency around what you get involved in.
Yeah.
And so local farmers would also hunt alongside the Anglo-Irish, you know, it was a mixed, it was
they could dress how they
a
liked.
Motley crew.
That
yeah.
was interesting. Yeah, didn't notice that bit myself.
And so I experienced this from a young age and I had no idea about colony, class, what it meant, inheritance, the black and tans. No, I knew in school that we were very lucky that men, great men saved Ireland. from 800 years of oppression.
Yeah.
And Ireland was great. And I must be very thankful. And that's what I felt deeply, and a really deep sense of pride in that.
And the violence ended as well.
Oh, it all.
When we got rid of them.
Oh, we did. Yeah. We walked ourselves into a few decades of incredible violence.
Yeah.
And so the horse really is just a kind of a symbol of that Ireland and how these people mixed and how assimilation happens and how it's not as clear cut as dividing. And as I started to get older and started to read McGaughran, actually Maeve Binchy's echoes in the town and on. Yeah. And I thought, oh, this is unusual. This is strange. They do, you know, they wore hairnets and stuff. And they seem to have a lot of power in this hunt situation. Mm-hmm. So there was a hierarchy, I felt. We were at the back, the farmers' children.
It's 1990. It's,
I know.
Like, it's very surprising, but it feels totally true.
It was the kind of the end tale, I felt, of that. You know, there were people on that hunt with titles.
Yeah.
Lady.
Right.
Yeah.
Still holding on to them. From whom?
Yeah, but I was fascinated by it. But yeah, the father thinks, hopefully the father will sell a horse to the Queen of England. This big rumour goes around the town that the Queen of England is coming to Athenry to buy horses for the Queen, as if she's coming herself. And it's going to be the kind of their freedom. It's going to be their upward mobility. It may save the family. It may save the farm. And they take a special interest in his black mare. And that sequence of 1990 really helps us understand Claire's stagnant confusion in her life. She hasn't faced that event.
No.
And so we see it then from the third person, and then later on we will see it in a different
completely
perspective.
Completely different.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really clever. I also was interested in how the townspeople essentially act the fool, don't they, to oppress these fellas.
The Chacron.
Coming in.
The Yambusagalt is like hop. Yeah, well, it's the kind of that idea of language. You know, when you're under oppression, words are your weapon, you know. And so that is, there's a legacy of that, I think. There's a legacy of language, of subversion, of kind of not saying what you want, the half-talk code of mystery and the wink and elbow language of delight, sort of.
Beautiful Kavanagh.
Yeah, but when I read Kavanagh, I was like, you're so right. But he was talking about, you know, townspeople. But I mean, we have to also include, you know, God, I'm giving you all the literary Yeats is sort of fumbling in the greasy till, and the petty bourgeois of the Irish Catholic middle
class. It's all in there. I should also say, it is great crack, this.
Yeah, novel. Please. Thank you. Okay, I've turned everybody off with
this. Poor old Tom. I mean, I particularly love the bit, he spots the mad picture of the Sacred Heart. With the light underneath him, and he says, "Jesus, it's like a bulb. It's like a bulb you'd find in a whorehouse." And I'm going,
"That blasphemy!
This Sassenach has offended us." But poor man doesn't know what he's talking about, does he? He's just, this is all new to him.
He doesn't, but he's sort of enraptured with the Irish men that go on ultramarathons and sail across oceans, and he just wants to figure them out. But he really does not understand history. He doesn't have a clue, and he's in this part of the world. And of course, Claire's brothers meet him and they see him as the stranger. One of them doesn't. And that all permeates the atmosphere. And I was really just exploring what it would be like for the Englishman in a town, if that makes sense.
I know
it sounds plenty of us are all married and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it was just that idea of coming in and the inheritance and going back to primogeniture and this idea that he comes in to the bungalow and the brother immediately is suspicious of him.
Yes.
And Tom is totally unknowing. He has no clue.
Yeah,
he's just cleaning up.
It kind of exposes our arrogance, a bit like the trad wives, where we have this view of the English ourselves. And then when you sort of start to realise, how would they know the dynamic of inside an Irish family home?
Yeah, but maybe they should know.
Well, that argument is...
sorry. This sounds very binary. Like, it's not, you know. It's complicated.
Back to the crack, because Claire is very jealous of this Joanna woman.
Oh, Joanna.
Who drives a Tesla. I noticed you put it there.
I had that in before.
Did you really?
All the stuff went down. Yeah.
But yeah. I think there's great comedy in how she views her and imagines a lot of
Joanna.
Her.
So Tom comes to the West. He doesn't go to Claire's house, interestingly, because they're not back together. He is, and so he's staying in Joanna's house to write his book because Joanna's helping him. And this is the interesting thing. I love this, like people giving people houses to actually write their books. You know, that's fascinating.
That's a great idea.
I love that. Yeah. So if any listeners want to give me a house for a summer, and then Joanna is there for part of the summer, and she also visits, and she has this interesting conversation with Claire in a very interesting sequence when Claire actually starts to kind of say, okay, I'll put it up to her, because she's jealous of her, because she thinks maybe Tom and her are having a little fling, and she starts to have feelings again for Tom. And yeah, Joanna says, I don't live here in this house. Yes. You couldn't actually live here. We summered here, a verb.
Yes.
So I think I'm going to divide people from now on.
We hate
summered
her so much.
And people who have no houses, yes.
There's a message, Elaine, saying, don't give away all the storyline. We want to read it. They're actually giving it to me, actually. Oh. Don't worry, we haven't given nothing away. We haven't even gone into the 1920s,
no.
Which is like, that's the horror. But it's extraordinary. And you feel guilty of the kind of the thrilling nature of that sort of horror in a weird way, if you know what I mean? Because I don't think we talk about the Civil War a lot, but we actually don't go into the details of Black and Tan towns very often.
Or the fact, and if we go back to the kitchen from the top of the chat, that kitchen space being this intimate space, but where really violent things can happen. And today it comes into that space in the 90s also, you know, and that whole notion that the Black and Tans and the reprisals came into people's domestic space, into the countryside.
Yes, very good.
You know, and
I made the mistake of reading that bit at night.
Sorry.
But look, it's an extraordinary, a brilliant novel.
We have to try and sell it now.
Get out. You don't
just
have
read
to sell
it during the day.
This is your third one. They've loved the previous ones. They'll go again. Let me go mad in my own way is how you don't say it. Elaine Feeney, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And sure, we'll see you for the next one.
You will.
But Let Me Go Mad in My Own Way for the meantime. Now, welcome back. Convicted criminal Gerard the Monk Hutch became a huge story of the general election. He won over 3,000 first preference votes and narrowly missed out on the fourth seat in Dublin Central. The result captured the attention of the global media because, of course, Hutch is a gangland figure. Actor Rex Ryan runs the Glass Masks Theatre in Dublin and his next play is all about the monk. Good morning, Rex.
Morning. How are you?
This is a one-man show, isn't it?
It is.
But curiously for a one-man show, it's based on Gerard Hutch's trial at the Special Criminal Court, unusually, I would say, for a courtroom drama.
Mm-hmm.
People will remember he was acquitted of the murder of David Byrne at that infamous Regency Hotel shooting. What are you getting yourself in for here?
Well, the conception of this piece was that, obviously, this is one of the biggest crime stories, let's say, over the last 10 years or so. And he was a figure that I was always fascinated with. The background was that the Hutch family were residents of Clontarf, and I grew up around there.
Right.
So
they were neighbours of yours.
We weren't exactly neighbours, but around the same area.
Right.
So they were known around the area. But of course, back then, as a young man, I was ignorant to any of this stuff and none of it was a big deal. I just knew them as any other family. And then as I grew up, you start to understand what the story was and the sort of mythic proportions around it. Fast forward, I run a theatre, a New Riding Theatre. We've talked about it before, Glass Mask Theatre. And by a chance encounter with a member of the family, I'd ended up talking about Gerard Hutch. And this is when the theatre was up and running. It's going brilliantly. We're doing new plays. And it was mentioned to me off the cuff that he had said it would be interesting if I had played him. This started as a joke.
Right.
And then I went off and I began to mull this possibility. And as I thought on it, Oliver, I dug into this story, I realised that not only potentially was I dealing with a fascinating character that could be portrayed in a theatrical manner that could rock people, but I also thought that this story, his story, for me, was a mirror in a way to Ireland's evolution. So if I track Gerry's beginning to Ireland's, starting with an innocent sort of pre-European country of the 70s, and then his trajectory right up to the Celtic Tiger, which had all his excesses and madness and the greed of that time, juxtaposed, I suppose, with what was happening with Ireland and contrasted, but also the similarities, I thought that I could get a strange snapshot of Ireland through one man.
It sounds like a massive stretch because immediately we're thinking, Gerard Hutch in Ireland? Like, get out of town. Absolutely no correlation. But can I take a step back, because you knew one of his children in your childhood and this was the chance encounter you had of someone you'd met, probably hadn't seen since childhood, I presume.
Yes, well, I knew all of them, as did many people around Clontarf. They were Clontarf residents, well known. And
you would have had conversations?
Sure, I knew the son. Nice guy.
Did you ever talk about his dad with him?
So when we were younger, the fame or infamy of both our fathers was not really, we weren't too cognizant of it. It was normal to us. So that was never really a discussion. This discussion only happened when we were grown up, so to speak, and we realised what his story was.
You never talked about each other's dad, in other words, as kids?
No. Wasn't a big deal.
So was it unusual then to have this conversation 3 years ago when you're grown up and families and so on of your own?
Well, it's a strange sort of time travelling machine having conversations like that. And it's something, like I said, I hadn't been thinking about it until that sparked it. And then I was reticent to go anywhere near this. Very much so.
Why?
It's, well, as you've already pointed out, it's a sensitive topic, particularly given recently that the fact the man ran for office and was voted for by a relatively large number of people. It's sensitive. Many people have also been hurt, killed during a lot of things surrounding that family and other families. And I run a theatre. I was thinking, I have a family. I was thinking, is this something I really want to get into? But then my ethos about stuff I want to create in there is that a lot of the greatest theatre I've ever seen, films, movies, books, etc., I'm sure you're the same, they provoke, they don't answer questions, they ask questions. And I thought through him, I could ask some questions that might be larger than the personal story of the man himself.
You wanted it to be uncomfortable?
I wanted to be uncomfortable. I wanted to maybe make people uncomfortable. I'd like to challenge, but I would also really enjoy entertaining. And I would also really enjoy, I suppose, the electricity and the possibility of sitting in a small room, which is our theatre, with this man who has become, for many reasons, a mythical figure. Mm-hmm. And I thought if I wrote a play that could give people a look at this man that they mightn't have gotten before, because it's my fiction. This is a fictional piece written by me.
If I could, on a real person, however.
On a real person, absolutely. And if I could give a look at him, and also a look at Ireland and why this man has become famous, so to speak, I thought it could be interesting.
Now, the first kind of protocol for your research, it's been going on quite some time, hasn't it? Because it's, what, the summer of 2022, and his son arranges a call between the pair of you because he's in custody awaiting trial for the Regency murder he's acquitted of later. But what a sensitive time to be meeting him for the first time, albeit on a video call.
Yes.
What happens in that call? How is it set up? How does it go?
Well, of course, this was bizarre for me, but not totally bizarre, because I suppose Oliver, parts that I've played over the last 8 to 10 years or so, you do research and you find yourself in dicey, strange situations, also normal situations, but you have to, for me anyway, I have to try and get an account, a real account of the topic I'm dealing with, whether that's an actor, writer, director, or in this one, all three. So this was a very strange meeting. And this happened, like I said, after reticence from me of even if I wanted to tackle this subject, could I? Can I even play the man? You know, you think about all these things. So when I did the Zoom call, I didn't really have a plan. I went in.
It's set up by the guards, I presume.
It's set up by the guards. You got 30 minutes. It's a hard stop after 30 minutes.
Right.
And all I knew was I have to talk to this man who I knew around Clontarf as a child, and I have to strangely pitch to him, to his face, as he awaits trial, that I'm going to jump around a stage and pretend to be him. And not only that, but it's my fictional version of a snapshot of his life. And that's a strange pitch to a man who's awaiting trial at the Special Criminal Court.
And people will remember he had his hair all grown out. He had a big beard, kind of hamming up the sense of his own enigma in many ways. What do you say? What's the opening couple of sentences you say to him when he appears on the screen?
How are you, Jerry? How are things?
What does he say to you?
Grand. And then we ended up slipping into a conversation about Michael Mann's film Heat. De Niro, Robert De Niro, Al Pacino. We talked about Once Upon a Time in America. And what was supposed to be a pitch meeting ended up becoming a strange chat about our favourite films.
Gangster films?
Predominantly.
Does he like them? I mean, what was so strange? What does he say about these?
Well, both of us really like Heat by Michael Mann, and we discussed our favourite character in that. We enjoyed Pacino, and...
You're dancing around the thing that you come to talk about, and he knows what you're going to ask him.
There's 3 minutes left. I look up at the time and I realise that thing's about to cut off, and I haven't said one word about the one-man show. Mm-hmm. And I haven't talked to this man in the longest time. And also, he's given me his call, which could, I presumably, have been used for a family member or something.
Right.
So I vomit out, I think I should play you in a one-man show in my theatre. And he took a pause, and then he said, you do whatever you like.
Right, so you took that as a blessing.
I ran with that. And we were clear in the parameters, and then just as we began talking again, the thing cut off.
He's cut off, and then he goes off into trial. And the trial is 52 days long. The non-jury court, of course, acquits him. So he gives you the permission to write something about him.
Yes.
But he's telling you this is going to be your version of him. So obviously that's the fiction thing, isn't it?
Well, I was quite clear that it has to be my fiction because, number one, I didn't want this play. The thing, Oliver, with a play is, particularly a one-person play, the form, how you do it is crucial, because I didn't want to get up, sit on a chair and say, Howie, I'm Jerry Hutch, here's my life story. That's not interesting to me. And the theatre's a great place where you can manipulate and warp time. And you can do things in the theatre that a lot of things that you might not get away with in film or television. Mm-hmm. And one of the things is jumping into someone's imagination. So I had an idea that I wanted to make a play about the inside of this man's mind that was unseen. And in order to do that, I needed it to be a fiction because, of course, I'm going to have to infer things about his life. I'm going to have to fill in character details that man won't tell me. Won't tell anybody. So if I was bound to anyone's point of view, whether that's Paul Williams, whether that's Nicola Tallant, whether that's Jerry Hutch, that would really box me in as a writer. Then again, you're dealing with something that is a well-known public story. A lot of it, it's public domain. So there are certain things, there are certain aspects of the story you must stay true to. So it was a tightrope, man. It's a really tricky process in the creation of the story.
After your initial phone call, you've obviously got what you consider the blessing. He's a free man. He moves off to Spain. Mm. It kind of goes by the wayside, the idea, for a bit, does it? But then you get his number from his son, I presume, and you start WhatsApping the monk.
Yes. I went off the idea. I was directing plays in Glass Mask. I was on a television series, and I thought deeply about it, and I thought, do I really want to open this thing up? And then one night, as cliche as this sounds, I was in the middle of a play. I watched The Godfather, turned it on to relax one night, and I thought, why do we watch these things? Why do we watch these tragedies? Mm-hmm. Why are we obsessed with these stories for thousands of years? Why do we watch the downfall of people? Why are we fascinated with criminality specifically? Why are we fascinated with rebels? The Godfather was an interesting example. It's not really a gangster story. It's a story about a father and a son. It's a story about a family. It's a story about sin, forgiveness. These are all ripe materials for storytelling, the ingredients I love particularly for the theatre. And I thought, this story, this isn't really about my ultimate fascination with Jerry Hutch. I thought, this is the raw material of a story where I could get at some major, more macro themes like the nature of fame, sin, forgiveness, media, truth. And I thought, using this man's story as a vehicle, I might be onto something.
There seems to be a lot of kind of high notions around someone like Jerry Hutch. And from his public pronouncements, as you say, you have to imagine his thoughts. Mm. Maybe there's nothing really much going on up there.
I wonder why people are fascinated by the man then. Apart from the fact he's a convicted criminal. Mm. Why are people fascinated with this man's story? And why did thousands of people vote for him? These are questions I have myself. Why and how did that man take over the large, probably the largest proportion of publicity for the elections? What does that say about us?
Do you have any of the answers?
I have opinions, but I don't know if I have answers.
Okay.
And I think that's probably a large reason why I wrote the play.
When you get back in touch with him, are you texting him? Do you call him? What do you do when you have his number?
Well, we were in discussion. Like I said, I had to have a few sources for the play, but we were in discussion when I needed to get facts for the character. I'm not chatting to him now, and I think it's probably important that I have a removal from everybody now. Right. And I'm in rehearsals. I'm trying to make the show. So I need to just put my head down and focus on creating a piece of theatre.
Yeah.
But I think it's probably good to have removal from everybody. I should, after this interview, I should just go into a hole.
Yeah, but get back to the research, because you're in contact with him, aren't you? Send him voice notes?
During the writing process, yes.
Right, okay.
I had loads of questions.
Everybody hates voice notes. How does he react to these?
Does everybody hate voice notes?
A lot of people. Imagine the kind of older generation of which he's in that group.
Well, that's a disaster because I only send voice notes.
All right, don't.
Specifically, I send 6 to 10 minute voice notes to everybody.
Go away. No one's listening to those.
Yeah, I just kept back the thumbs up sign. So I'm bombarding this man with questions to try and fill out my character.
In a voice note?
In a voice note.
Are you sending him 6 minute voice notes?
7, 8 minutes.
And how does Jerry Hutch respond to these diatribes of notes?
Concisely.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
Does he send a voice note back?
No.
All right.
These are concise answers.
So he sends very short text messages back.
Well, I'm sure he'd be slightly reticent as well about giving me information. But I needed to get information that maybe hasn't been in the media. I need to get things about early life, establishing
your
character.
You're fact-checking.
That stuff.
Okay. When you've done all the voice notes and you still meet him in person, don't you? Is there more you need to find out?
Yeah. And also when you're playing someone, it's helpful to look them in the eye and try and get a read on the person and see what their energy is.
This is post-election or before?
Pre.
It's before the election. Okay.
Pre, yes.
Meeting him in person, and you know this guy from your childhood. He was the neighbour. He's a dad of a fella you knew growing up. He's a chief suspect, according to the Gardaí, in armed robberies. When you're meeting him face to face for the first time, and I think you're alone, aren't you?
Yeah.
Did it seem to you like a good idea?
The first one, actually, we weren't. That was in a public place. Did it seem to me a good idea? You see, I suppose you have to take me as not your normal case because of the job I do. So I'm trying to meet, and this would go for anyone that I'm trying to play. I'm trying to meet that person and be as objective as possible because I'm trying to create a story about them, a piece of theatre. So I'm trying to erase all of that extra curricular extraneous thing. I'm trying to get that out of my head and I'm trying to meet, I suppose, a man face to face and see if I can be, whatever I believe personally, I'm trying to see, like an investigative journalist maybe, I'm trying to see, can I take him exactly as I'm seen him today.
Yeah.
But then when I'm writing the play, I can go off.
I see.
And I can have my own.
So does the character you meet in person, is he deeper? Is there more depth to him in person?
He's a complicated man, for sure. And I suppose anyone who's gone through what he's gone through so publicly, that has to have had some effect on how willing you are to open yourself up to anybody. So I imagine that he is as much of a mystery to me still as...
Do you mean what he went through in terms of the... What do you mean by that?
Well, I suppose being in the public eye for so long, being on trial publicly, living in that world, I can only imagine that these are, in terms of your psyche, these are really taxing things, and it would be hard not to be adversely affected by that. And
you're sympathetic towards him.
Well, let's say I would be sympathetic towards many people who have gone through hurt. But what I can't do is make a judgment when I'm trying to make the play. But I suppose if someone's family were murdered and you were in that world, it's certainly something that I wouldn't wish for myself or my family, and that's something that would terrify me.
He still has a threat on his life, as he would have when you met him as well. Did he strike you as someone who was fearful?
He didn't seem fearful when I met him, but once again, I think he would have to be aware for the rest of his life.
Did you like him?
I suppose when I'm meeting him, I'm trying not to think like that, because if I lean too far one way or the other, I'm going again to get into territory that I don't want to. So the play is me as him.
Yeah, and obviously these meetings, are you telling him what's going to happen in the play?
Yeah.
Did he ask you to change anything?
No.
Okay.
Not specifically. I sent him the script, the finished script, recently.
Right.
And there were a couple things that were factually incorrect. There were notes on that. And then there's some really challenging things in the script. Really challenging things. I mean, the whole premise of the play is that he's been taken to task.
You're saying there's parts of that would be negative for him that he didn't comment on when you sent him the script?
Yeah, I'd say so.
So when people go to see the play, what exactly are we seeing? Because he's on trial, is he? It's a kind of a courtroom drama, and you've written what's going on in his mind.
It's 5 minutes before the verdict of the Special Criminal Court,
right,
which the vast majority of people already know the verdict of. It's set 5 minutes before it. He's sitting in the cell, and he essentially goes into his mind in a prayer. He's often referenced the fact he was asked this on the Nicola Tallant podcast. Did he feel that there were angels watching over him because he survived so many? He survived at least two explicit attempts on his life. And he said he felt that like there was guardian angels watching over him. That stuck with me. So I took the premise of that some sort of angel visits him. As the clock ticks, 4 minutes, 3 minutes, 2 minutes to go to the trial. And the angel takes him to task for key moments in his life before he goes out to the judges.
When did you last have contact with him? Because you said you shut it off after your research and the writing was done.
Well, I think our business was done. I can't remember when the last one was, but it's been a good while now.
Months?
Probably.
Do you think he's going to go see the play?
I don't know. I really don't know. I know a lot of people who have been involved in this story on many sides are coming to see it. I know a lot of people in the media who are coming to see it, and they'll be very interested. I don't know if he's coming.
Okay, so The Monk will be performed at the Glass Mask Theatre on Dawson Street in Dublin from the 10th of June to the 21st. Good luck, Rex Ryan. Thanks a million.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye. And there you go, some great interviews from the past week. It is the end of the podcast, as you know it. If you have any interesting stories and things you think we definitely should know, pop us an email anytime at all, oliver@rte.ie. Happy weekend to you. Agus slán.